From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Peter Biello, and this is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange. The New Hampshire House advances legislation that would make equal the definitions of domicile and resident, which could have implications for voting. A top regional VA official retires months after VA whistleblowers call for his removal, and the Executive Council votes to give $600,000 to Hope for New Hampshire. These and other stories made headlines this week. We will talk about them in this hour. And you can call into The Exchange at 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. You can also send an email to exchange@nhpr.org or post on our Facebook page at NHPR Exchange. That's all one word. And we are also streaming a live video of this radio show, so it is very easy to listen and watch. You can check out the stream on our Facebook page, NHPR Exchange, or just search for New Hampshire Public Radio on Facebook. And here to talk about the week's news and answer your questions about it are Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at SNHU, author of the website NH Political Capital, NHPR's Annie Ropeek, and political reporter Paul Steinhauser. Everybody, thank you very much for being here.
Thank you.
Great to be here. Peter.
Yeah.
So again, the phone number for you to call to join the conversation, 1-800-892-6477. Also email exchange@nhpr.org. We're going to start the show talking about domicile, resident, inhabitant, these terms. A bill in the House would sort of merge the definition to make them all one. These are oft repeated when lawmakers debate someone's eligibility to vote in New Hampshire. Paul, why do these definitions matter?
They matter greatly because there is a huge fight here in New Hampshire over who can vote, whether out-of-staters who are domiciled in New Hampshire can vote. This fight has been going on for quite some time. Republicans in the state, a lot of conservatives have said for years that there is voter fraud, that Democrats try to game the system, bring others in from over state lines to vote in our elections. That's why we saw the big fight and the new law, Senate Bill 3, became a law last year, which tightened up the voting rules and regulations here in New Hampshire. Now the fight over the last couple of months has been over two bills, and one of them was just passed, as you said, this week by the State House of Representatives. What it does is basically kind of bring the definition of domicile and residency together, and it also mandates that if you're going to vote in New Hampshire, you have to be a resident, which means, well, you're going to have to either register your car or get a license. Democrats say this is voter suppression. Republicans say, no, we're just trying to get things in line and make it more uniform. It's a huge political fight. We saw it last year over last year's bill, which is now a law. We're seeing it this year. It may end up in court.
And they say it's suppression. Democrats say it's suppression in part because college students are often domiciled, not residents, and they tend to vote Democrat.
Exactly. And this really does affect college students in some of the bigger towns like Durham and Keene, Plymouth. And you know what? A lot of those students often vote for Democrats. Republicans say, wait a minute, you know, Donald Trump may have won the election in 2016 in New Hampshire, you know, if it wasn't for all these out-of-staters who were voting in our election. So there's a lot of upset people on both sides. And again, I think it may end up in court. This bill may end up in court.
So wait, how is this different from House Bill 372, which also was addressing voter eligibility?
They're pretty much the same bill. That's okay. The beauty of the New Hampshire legislature. When you have 424 lawmakers, you do often have a lot of repeat bills. The other bill you just mentioned has already been passed through the state Senate. This one just got passed through the state house. We'll see if they get merged together or how it works out. We still have a couple months to go in this legislative food fight session.
Dean, what's the governor saying about this?
Yeah, well, it's interesting. We're waiting to see. He said he's monitoring the situation. He had been supportive of SB 3, but then had said that that was about as far as he wanted to go. He was recorded saying in an interview that he did not want to disenfranchise college students, that he didn't think we needed any additional regulation. We'll see if he backs away from that. I think if this eventually gets to his desk, it's going to be a pretty significant test of his independence as a chief executive, because these kinds of pieces of legislation are very popular among Republicans. It mirrors a national debate around the country about whether or not there's voter fraud and what is at the root of that voter fraud. And, you know, we have a history in the state of complications in understanding what's meant by domicile. There's this phrase, you know, the place that you are more than anywhere else. This HB 1264 As does HB 372, equates or makes domicile equivalent with residency. You know, it's going to, if it passes and is signed into law, it will end up in court with the argument that it's a violation of civil rights because it, in effect, puts in place a form of a poll tax. If you're required to establish full residency in order to vote, that usually means registering your car, paying taxes on the car, getting a driver's license, costs money to do that. In particular, the argument will be that it disenfranchises college students who spend most of their year within the state. So this is not the last we'll hear of this, but I am very interested to see what Governor Sununu does. As I said, this will be a real test of his independence as a chief executive. He has said that SB3 was sufficient, that he didn't think we needed anything more. Now he sort of has kind of keeping his cards a little closer to the vest. So we'll see what he does.
Okay. And normally we could spend a whole hour on this.
And you guys have on this show.
And sure. We certainly
and
have.
And you will again, I'm sure, Peter.
Yes, certainly. But, I mean, this has been such a busy week for the legislature. We're just going to breeze through a variety of stories
next.
Here. We don't call this a roundup for nothing, right? Okay. So let's talk about the fact that we will not, in fact, see a bill banning bump stocks
tried
introduced.
Tried to squeeze that one in this week, but they didn't manage to do it.
Let's try and squeeze this a short discussion of this one in. This bill would have raised the legal age to purchase long guns from 18 to 21, would have banned bump stocks. Democrats were not successful in introducing this. Paul, why?
They tried. This was a last-minute maneuver a couple days ago in the State House of Representatives at the beginning of the session. The top Democrat in the chamber Steve Shurtleff tried to bring this up, change the rules. You need a two-thirds vote to do that. He tried to reintroduce this bill last fall, wasn't successful then. Remember, it also a similar bill got voted, basically voted down in the state Senate, and he was unsuccessful this time as well. Even with all that's going on right now in the country after the horrific shootings down in South Florida, even after the state legislature in Florida is just about to do the same thing. It's already passed through the legislature. We'll see if the governor down there, the Republican governor, signs it into law. They were unsuccessful here. Republicans say that it wasn't about, not that they don't support these moves. They just said you weren't following the rules. We've already had discussions on this. This fight will continue and continue throughout this legislative session. This is a huge issue right now with voters, and it just shows the emotions in the wake of Parkland.
And what's interesting is, you know, by trying to suspend the rules, it gave Republicans an opportunity to essentially avoid having a debate on the issue and simply say, this is not the way to go about doing this, mm-hmm. without having to make a statement one way or the other about whether or not they would support the changes. So essentially telling Mr. Shurtleff to use the normal procedure with the filing period and public hearings, et cetera.
This is a fight that if it doesn't really reemerge in the state legislature this year, you're going to hear about it on the campaign trail this summer and this fall.
All right. Another thing worth noting this week, Annie, House lawmakers voted Wednesday to expand New Hampshire's anti-discrimination law to include transgender people. What protections would this law provide?
So this would add gender identity to the state's anti-discrimination statute that already exists. So that covers things like housing discrimination, employment discrimination, public accommodations. It basically says you can't discriminate against a person on the basis of sex, race, you know, all of those things. And it would add gender identity to that list. So that includes transgender people, people who identify as a different sex than the one that they were assigned at birth. It basically is seen as a transgender rights bill in the state, as giving transgender people sort of state-ordained rights that they don't currently have.
And Linz Jacobs is a non-binary transgender person who campaigned for the transgender rights bill. Here's that tape.
Most people haven't yet met someone who's transgender, and it becomes easy to believe those fear-mongering stories that we all hear when you actually haven't connected a face and a real story to the issue of discrimination.
Paul?
This bill now moves to the state Senate, where there seems to be a lot of support. The governor himself is now on record as saying he will support this as well. You know, every time this bill has come up in committee, there's been a lot of activists out there in support of it. It's got a lot of support around the state, and we'll probably be talking about it becoming a law in a few months from now.
Mm-hmm. What were opponents saying about this?
Yeah, so they basically center on what I call the bathroom argument. Mm-hmm. And honestly, the first time this came up in debate on the House floor this week, I could hear groans from the House floor as well as in the gallery. This is, you know, I think to some a pretty tired argument, which basically says that we're worried that if transgender people can use the bathroom that corresponds to their gender identity, that you'll have men going into women's bathrooms and sexually assaulting them willy-nilly.
When this passed the other day, I think you were up in the gallery, right? And that's you're not supposed to make any noise when votes are happening. But what happened when that happened?
Well, yeah, so there had been, you know, a lot of audible reaction throughout the day. And then when it did finally pass, there was a huge cheer, some people yelling, thank you. And they were quickly shushed and all went out in the hallway to celebrate.
Yeah, you had some great tape of that this week. Good to hear. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello. Still to come, we're going to be talking about DCYF and balance billing. Send us your thoughts by email, exchange@nhpr.org, or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Let's talk about DCYF. The Senate Health and Human Services Committee voted unanimously on Tuesday for a bill that would restore funding to certain services at DCYF, $1.5 million. Dean, what are the services we're talking about
here? These are the so-called voluntary services, and this really stems from the very tragic incident of the murder-suicide, the father and six-year-old son in Derry, and the our new child advocate, this new position that was created in order to have somebody to kind of act as a sort of an external check on DCYF and what's going on with all the different cases. She had been very critical, saying that if some of these services, if there had been other, the issue was that the I guess the family had reached out for some help, but they didn't technically qualify for the kinds of services they needed. So this is a way to kind of fill in that gap and provide a bit more of a safety net for people looking for help. So I think in many respects, this is kind of a direct result of having the child advocate come out and say that this was a missed opportunity to help this family.
Annie?
So my understanding is that these are voluntary services. So like Dean was saying, it's kind of this gray area, right, between someone who, you know, is in clear, direct, imminent need of assistance and someone who has cause for concern but maybe hasn't, like, crossed the bar yet to actually get into the system. So it would provide counseling and child care and other treatments for those people that sort of fall into that middle ground, which is what we seem to think that this family...
Well, and that was the issue. Apparently they had reached out, but they didn't trigger the typical, required interactions, and so there wasn't any other option. So this is a way to kind of fill that out a bit voluntarily.
And it seems, according to the report, Moira O'Neill, the child advocate, was saying that this is pretty common in other states. Right, that other states have these things pretty well funded.
Yeah, I guess that our system is a lot more underfunded than other states. This is usually something that's on offer.
I see. Okay. What's next for this funding bill? Do we know? Remains to be seen, I guess we could say.
Yeah, not sure where it is in the process.
All right. Well, let's talk about one more thing here. Balance billing, because a bipartisan measure to protect patients against so-called balance billing got a strong endorsement from the New Hampshire House on Tuesday. Busy week for the House. They've done a lot. Sailing through with no debate, overwhelming support. But let's back up a little bit and talk about what balance billing actually is. Dean, what is it?
Yeah, balance billing is for example, if you go to the emergency room with some kind of injury or you're needing treatment because you're sick, and it's in-network services and in-network hospital, your expectation is you will be covered in the normal and customary way by your insurance company. If there may be individual doctors or nurses or other services, pathology that are provided by out-of-network doctors or nurses or services, and that bills at a much higher rate. So people are basically getting surprises tucked into their medical bills to the tune of thousands of dollars. And so this is an attempt to basically have that stop happening and require the hospitals and insurance companies to sort of figure it out amongst themselves rather than passing that cost on to the consumer. This is something that has been an increasing concern in the state. So the House approved this particular bill as a way of protecting consumers when they go in to get medical treatment.
And what's the history of this legislation? I mean, is this brand new or have lawmakers been working on this for a while?
I'm not sure how far it goes back. I've heard a lot about it over the last 6 months or so. You know, I think this has been something that health insurance costs, billing, et cetera, something that's been talked about for some time. The decision to actually act on this now, I'm not sure how far back that goes.
Mm-hmm. And what about the governor? Has he indicated support or opposition to this one way or the other?
I don't know.
I see.
But I think there's my sense is in general there is support for this. I think there's going to be some pushback from providers and insurance companies, but this is viewed as something that is good for the consumers. And you read about the bill, and there are a number of anecdotes of people who literally socked with thousands of dollars from out-of-network doctors or services when they thought they were being covered in-network.
Mm-hmm. NHPR's Casey McDermott has been doing some great reporting on this subject, by the way. Check it out at nhpr.org if you have some time. Let's talk about Medicaid expansion, because this happened just last night, right? After nearly 2 hours of debate, the New Hampshire Senate approved a plan to keep the state's Medicaid expansion going for another 5 years. Paul, this decision a long time coming?
It was expected in the state Senate because this is where that bill originated. It was really championed by the state Senate President Chuck Morris and Jeb Bradley, the majority leader. As you mentioned, listen, this plan, the Medicaid expansion plan, which was set up through the Affordable Care Act, which many of us know as Obamacare, and ensures about 50,000 people in the state. A lot of the money from that program goes for treatment and recovery services for those dealing with addiction misuse, substance misuse. So it's an important program. I think most people were on the same page that it needed to be continued. But how to do that? This plan would continue the program for 5 years, but it would make some changes to it. And it would also add a work requirement. In fact, one of the toughest work requirements of any state in the nation. That's the controversial part that a lot of people disagree on. It would also increase the alcohol fund, the liquor revenues, to about 5% to pay for this, because the federal piece of the pie is going to reduce every year. So the state has to pick up more payments here. It passed 17-7. All the Democrats were on board, all 10 Democrats. There were the 14 Republicans in the state Senate split, 7 for it, 7 against it. Peter, now the big test comes in the State House of Representatives. This is going to be the real fight here. The Senate, we had a feeling it was going to pass, and it did. In the House, this is going to be a big battle over the next few months. The governor is on board. He would like to see this happen.
Dean?
Yeah, just real quick, Paul mentioned the gap in federal funding. As federal funding decreases, the state has to make that up, which has been one of the concerns of people who oppose this. And the sort of 5% of liquor funds really to replace what had been contributions from hospitals, insurance companies, which the federal government said we can't do. That had been the way they had initially tried to fill that gap. You know, for me, this issue is really interesting politically. This is the one issue on which I've really seen kind of Governor Sununu sort of evolve in terms of how he positions himself. He had initially been very critical of expanded Medicaid during the campaign. He said he might oppose it. He didn't know. I think then he saw with the Obamacare repeal attempts how important this particular expansion is to people in the state, and he started to come around a little bit, and now I think he's generally in favor of it under the right circumstances. Republicans really like the work requirement. That is something that around the country, as states have grappled with this, Republicans have tried to insert into the reauthorizations.
Though the work requirement's likely to face a legal challenge, correct?
It could, and remember, this isn't the first time that New Hampshire has tried to get the federal government to say yes to the work requirements. During the Obama administration, they said no. Now we have the Trump administration. They're much more receptive to these kind of work requirements.
Okay. Well, listeners, you can be forgiven if you're feeling a little bit like you've been whiplashed here, because we've been breezing through so many stories. You can imagine how lawmakers must feel for all the work they've had to do this
March
week.
March Madness. That's what they were calling it this week.
That's an apt name for it, I think. We're going to get through a few more of these stories with the remainder of this hour, including the vote to raise the minimum age for marriage, the vote to shoot down Indigenous Peoples Day as a state thing. And we'll also talk about Steve Marchant, Democratic candidate for governor. That's all coming up, and we'd love to have your voice as part of this conversation. So give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Again, that's 1-800-892-NHPR. Anything goes, give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange. I'm Peter Biello. We will be right back.
Hi, I'm Jessica Hunt. I'm a producer for The Exchange. Thank you for listening to the podcast. I'm really excited because I am getting to put together a retrospective about Something Wild. That's another podcast on NHPR. You'll hear it during Morning Edition on Friday mornings. They have been doing that for 20 years, and I am delighted to be able to put together a special episode of The Exchange about Something Wild and their time on the air. But I'm coming to you because I need your help. I need to hear your memories, things that have touched you over the years about Something Wild. Here's the phone number to leave a voicemail, 603-513-7797. Thanks a lot.
This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello here in the studio with Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at SNHU, and the author website NH Political Capital, political reporter Paul Steinhauser, and NHPR's Annie Ropeek. We'd love to hear from you. If you have questions about the week's news, give us a call. The number is 1-800-892-6477. You can also send us an email if you'd like. The address is exchange@nhpr.org. It's been a busy week in Concord for New Hampshire legislators, and we're going to talk about some of the things they've done, some other news of the week as well. A lot of legislative news, though. And we'll talk about the marriage age, because the state House of Representatives voted on Tuesday to raise the marriage age in New Hampshire to 16, with judicial approval required until age 18. Right now, girls could marry at 13, boys at 14 with permission of a judge. But it seems like there wasn't a whole lot of debate on this, Paul. It was pretty clear that legislators wanted to raise it to 16.
Yeah, I think it passed on a voice vote rather than an actual roll call vote, which was interesting. We thought there would be a lot of debate on this. There was debate when it passed through the committee. This has been kind of pushed by a teen from Barrington. Her name is Cassie Levesque. She went to Dover High, and this has been kind of her pet project. Last year, she pushed for a similar bill that would have raised the age to 18. That stalled in the State House of Representatives. They came back this year with a different one, 16, which is more palatable to some people who had problems with raising the age to 18. Now it moves on to the State Senate, where they think there is enough support. The governor has indicated he will pass it. I think a lot of people who had no clue were just scratching their heads that you could be 13 years old right now and get married as a girl, 14 as a boy. That seems a little young in this day and age, doesn't it?
Yeah, it seemed like, as far as I remember, the article said that the existing law was created in 1907.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, worth an update, it seems like.
Yeah.
All right, so let's talk about another piece of legislation this week. This one was not as successful as the marriage bill, which is that the House of Representatives voted down a bill Tuesday that would have replaced Columbus Day with Indigenous Peoples Day. Dean, who was in favor of this bill?
Mm-hmm. Well, this is it's interesting. This is a debate that's been going on increasingly over the years, both at the state level and nationally. You know, as historians have reconsidered Columbus and the interaction with Indigenous peoples, Native Americans, also in Central America, there's been a move to do one of two things, either replace Columbus Day with Indigenous Peoples Day or some other similar holiday. And then others have moved to, in addition to Columbus Day, recognize Indigenous Peoples Day. There was a discussion about this in Durham a little while back. I think in that case, the goal was that in addition to Columbus Day, have an Indigenous Peoples recognition. It sounds like you're suggesting this was to actually replace one with the other. That's a harder sell, I think, politically. Than doing them in tandem. But this is a debate that really has been sort of popping up all over the country in recent years.
Town of Durham actually they passed it. So in Durham, they do have now Indigenous Peoples
Day. It's in addition to Columbus Day, though, if I recall correctly.
Yeah.
It wasn't to replace it, right?
Exactly. And a couple of state reps from Durham actually introduced this bill at the State House to make it a state bill, a state law as well. You know, a lot of conservatives scratched their head. And then, again, of course, they point to Durham, which they consider the People's Republic of Durham. So, not going to happen this year here in New Hampshire.
Okay. Well, this is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange on NHPR. We are speeding through these stories because there are, in fact, so many of them. But slow us down if you'd like. Ask a question. We really want to hear from you. We did get a comment from Dennis in Barrington regarding the discussion we had on voter eligibility, the terms like domicile, resident, inhabitant. Dennis wrote to say, please do not perpetuate the myth that Republican proposals to restrict voter eligibility is designed to address, quote, voter fraud, which does not exist. These domicile bills are about limiting voting by college students. That's from Dennis in Barrington. Thanks very much for writing in, Dennis. And if you'd like to write in with your questions or comments, email exchange@nhpr.org. NHPR.org. Paul, did you want to mention something?
Yeah, Dennis has a great point, though. This issue so excites the base. Liberals, progressives think that the Republicans are just trying to suppress the vote, especially among college students. Republicans say, no, there is voter fraud in this state, and we have to do something about it. We remember all the controversy when President Trump, then President-elect Trump, pointed to New Hampshire and said that, you know, there were busloads of people coming over the border. We've been fighting this fight for a couple of years now, and we'll keep fighting it, I guess.
And I mean, we should point out to Dennis's point that there's little to no evidence that there are busloads of people coming over the border to vote in this state. And the state officials who have discussed that haven't really been able to point to any hard statistics here.
If he's a regular listener, he certainly knows I'm not perpetuating that myth. I've been very outspoken about that this is a red herring. It's problematic. We had the Voter Integrity Commission, which was, as I predicted, a disaster. This is going to keep coming up. It's being fought all over the country. It's going to end up as a civil rights issue in the courts. And I think that's where we're going to be.
All right, Dennis, thank you again for the email. We appreciate it. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup. If you've got questions or comments, give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. You can also post on our Facebook page at NHPR Exchange, which is also where you can watch a live streaming video of this broadcast. Let's talk about Steve Marchand. He's a Democrat challenging Governor Chris Sununu in this year's gubernatorial election. And he took some time this week to spell out some of his positions on this program. You can find that in the Exchange podcast, by the way, the full interview with Steve Marchand. One of those positions was on guns and gun safety. He drew sharp contrast between himself and Governor Chris Sununu on the subject of guns. He says he's not trying to implement gun control, just trying to stop gun violence. How's he proposing to do that, Paul?
He came out about a week ago with an event up in the North Country where he proposed a bunch of things that, you know, legislatively could be done here in New Hampshire, including, and we've been talking about these, you know, the bump stocks, raising the age, and he's continued these events. He did one in Keene earlier this week, and today he's going to be in Dover. I'll be covering that one as well. There's been some pushback. The state Republican Party urged Second Amendment supporters and gun owners to get up there and give Marchand a hard time. They did when he had that event, and he had a pretty lively debate with some Second Amendment people. But there is a clear contrast between Marchand, who right now still remains the only Democrat who's officially announced a bid for governor, and Governor Sununu when it comes to guns. The governor has been very clear. He thinks we need to beef up school safety, and he's touted what his administration has done, but he is not in favor of new laws. There is a very clear difference between these two people.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's hear from Steve Marchand on the subject of guns. Here's what he said earlier this week, or at least part of what he said earlier this week on the Exchange.
They said, are you going to take my gun away? And I said, have you been arrested for a domestic violence charge in the last 21 days? If you have, then yes. And if you have not, and you haven't done these sort of things, you have nothing to worry about.
So it seems like he's being very targeted with respect to what he would want to do with gun legislation.
And this state is a state that very jealously, you know, protects its Second Amendment rights. So unlike some other states where Democrats have been very successful on this issue, it's a little trickier here in New Hampshire, even in the wake of such horrific things like the shooting in Parkland, which left 17 people dead.
I should point out at this point that NHPR's Lauren Chulgin did some fantastic reporting on that very impromptu debate that Steve Marchand had with a lot of gun rights activists. You can find that at NHPR.org. The whole hour with Steve Marchand was not spent on guns necessarily. He spoke about legalizing marijuana. Paul, why did he say it was a good idea to do this?
Yeah, and this has been his big thing for a while. When he ran the first time in 2016, remember, he was a Democratic candidate in 2016. He lost the nomination to Colin Van Ostern, who eventually lost the general election to Chris Sununu. But Marchand was one of his big pushes back in 16. It is again, and a lot of people in the state feel the time has come for that. But also he says economically we can benefit from the you tax marijuana, and that money can really help the state in a lot of other areas.
Once again, here's Steve Marchand on marijuana.
They said most of your opiates, they're prescribed not to cure, but to mask over pain. It's pain relief. And in many, I would argue most of those cases, other ways that are far less addictive, one of them being legalized cannabis, would be a way to dramatically reduce the entry, the gateway. It's pain relief in a lot of cases. To expand that ability to access that will dramatically lower what ends up being the ultimate gateway that leads to heroin, fentanyl, maluse of prescription opiates, and so forth. To me, it's not a choice. It's actually one of the tools to help deal with the problem.
Not a choice, a way to help deal with the problem, marijuana legalization as a way to fight the opioid epidemic. Dean, you were going
to
say something?
Yeah, just take a step back for a minute and look at the bigger political picture. You know, Steve has been in politics for a long time. He was the mayor of Portsmouth in the mid-2000s. I think he believes that he got into the gubernatorial race too late the last time around, and that if he'd gotten in earlier, he might have had a better chance at the nomination. Perhaps. He received some criticism. He had been kind of a business moderate, and he took on the mantle of progressivism, you know, in the wake of Bernie Sanders' tremendous success in the state. He's pushed back against that argument that he shifted on his positioning. You know, in terms of what he's looking at for this election, you have a relatively popular governor who's been a very quick study in learning how to triangulate between conservatives and moderates and independents in the state. Give conservatives some of what they want, give moderates some of what they want. That's usually a pretty good recipe for a governor in New Hampshire. But Steve's a tenacious guy. He's been out arguing and campaigning nonstop for a number of months. You know, probably contextually, his best hope is that we know that the first midterm after a new president is typically rough on the president's party, which would be the GOP. Perhaps it'll be a big enough of a blue wave that even a relatively popular governor will get washed out. It's not impossible, but I think it's going to be a challenge for him, given my sense of how previous gubernatorial elections have gone. But he seems to be up for the fight, and we'll see if he's going to end up with maybe a primary challenger at some point.
It's certainly possible. It's still relatively early, right? Primary challengers could get in at this point.
Getting a little late,
yeah.
But getting
no?
a little late.
Okay.
But
well, let's talk
soon.
About that, because there is a primary challenger very likely. Her name is Molly Kelly. She spent 10 years in the state Senate, a Democrat, obviously, from the Monadnock region, Hillsdale, right next to Keene. She just set up an exploratory committee, which is a pretty clear sign that she's about to get in. She says she'll get the backing of Emily's List and some other large groups. The Me Too movement could be very helpful here. So for those of us who cover campaign politics, it looks like we may finally get a contested Democratic primary battle. But to the bigger point, New Hampshire governors rarely lose that re-election to a second two-year term. It's only happened once in the last 90 years.
Can you guys, I mean, I'm new to this state relatively. I don't understand that. Can you speak to why that never happens?
First of all, we're only one of two states in the country, us and Vermont, that have two-year terms for governors. Traditionally, they're four-year terms. So you really got to screw up around here if you're a governor to not get re-elected after 2 years. Again, that was only Craig. The only one who's done it was Craig Benson. Back in 2004, the Republican ran for re-election was defeated by John Lynch. And Governor Sununu, his approval ratings are doing well. He had a successful session last year, got a lot of his agenda passed. It's going to be tough, but definitely doable, but tough.
And that election when Lynch won was in 2004 was really kind of the beginning of the turning points for Democrats. 2006, you have the big Democratic tsunami. The Democrats take control of Congress, and then 2008, President Obama wins his first term. So Lynch really caught the sort of the front edge of that that Democratic wave. But I think it is a large part a feature of the sort of the two-year terms, and then also the way our state is kind of distributed ideologically with a lot of independents and usually a pretty good setup for governor for at least one term. You know, over time, it gets harder and harder.
It's like a four-year term with a performance review.
Exactly. Yeah. That's not a bad way to think of it.
Thank you.
Interesting. Okay. Two more things on Marchand was that one that he was proposing a gas tax, calling it the least bad way to fix the red list bridges. And he also spoke out against the work requirement for Medicaid. Worth mentioning, I don't know if those are positions that are going to endear him to voters or harm him politically. Dean, what's your sense?
Again, hard to know. It's this whole issue of sort of figuring out, you know, in a primary, it's certainly not going to hurt him in a primary. In a general election, you know, you got to fight over that center group of independents in addition to solidifying your own base. If it's a wave election and lots of Democrats turn out in far larger numbers than Republicans, that's certainly going to help him. It's not undoable, but I think it's going to be a challenge for him.
Now, the gas tax is interesting because, remember, we had this big debate earlier this year over whether the tolls should be raised, and eventually the governor said, not going to do it. There are a lot of problems with the existing, you know, with the highways right now in this state. And I think a lot of people feel, even though they don't want to pay more money at the tolls or more money for gas, that more money is needed to fix the roads in this state and the bridges and tunnels. Well, do we have any tunnels? I don't think so.
I don't recall any tunnels.
Yeah, no tunnels.
I know that Steve Marchand is pointing to the red list bridges as something that, you know, a gas tax hike, which I think he put maybe like a three or four, like several quote unquote cents figure on when Laura Knoy pressed him. So that money could go toward bridges.
It took 18 years to get the last one, so I think this is gonna be, that's a tough sell.
Okay, and if you know of any tunnels in New Hampshire, send us an email. tell us. I'm only half kidding here because I'd really like to know. Exchange at NHPR.org. Speaking of elections in 2018, let's talk about the one for Andrew Walensky's executive council seat, because Republican Jim Beard of Leominster announced his campaign for the District 2 seat. Who's Jim Beard?
That's a good question, because I wasn't even really that sure of Jim Beard before I reported this the other day. He's been in the private sector for a long time, a pilot, in fact, as well, worked in a lot of industries. He ran for the state Senate back in 2016 in the Republican primary. It was an open seat. He lost to Ruth Ward, who's now the state senator, in this GOP primary by just 9 votes. So that's about as close as you can get after 5, a recount. Yeah, after about 5,000 casts, exactly. So he's back again. This is interesting. The second district of the executive council starts over on the Vermont border. Keene goes through Concord all the way to Dover and Durham. It's a very pro-democratic district. You got a lot of college students. We were just talking about that. Mm-hmm. Walensky won the election for this district back in 2016, succeeding Colin Van Osteren, who had run for governor. But he didn't win by a heck of a lot. He only won by 7 percentage points. So, you know, there is a possibility here that the right Republican could maybe make this a interesting race.
It's tough. The redistricting of that district really made it a pretty safe Democratic district. You know, he's primarily going to be known in the Keene area, sort of the western part of the state, and, you know, he's got to get over to sort of east of Concord. He himself has acknowledged that he needs to get better known in sort of the Concord to Durham corridor if he wants to have a chance.
Okay. And speaking of Andrew Walensky, he was instrumental in trying to get Dudley Dudley's portrait put up at the State House, correct, Paul?
He was really the mastermind behind pushing, and prodding the governor and the administration to do that.
Can we back up for a moment and remind listeners who Dudley Dudley is?
Yes. Yeah. Let's definitely do that, because she is quite a woman. She's really a progressive icon and an inspiration to a lot of females in this state. She was the first female executive counselor ever in New Hampshire. We're talking going back, to the 1700s. So she was a progressive crusader back in the day. She was a state representative back in the 1970s. She was one of the leaders of the movement that stopped Aristotle Onassis.
That was an interesting
thing. Yeah, who had a lot of money, who was the Greek shipping tycoon, from actually opening up a oil refinery on the shores of Great Bay in Durham. This was a huge fight back in the 70s. She was one of the environmental activists who fought and prevented this from happening. So listen, she's got a great history. She's beloved by, obviously, Democrats and progressives, but also respected by Republicans. A painting of her was commissioned by Governor, that was approved by Governor Hassan. There was an unveiling of the portrait back in December of 2016. And then everybody thought, okay, great. Well, you know, it's going to go up. Guess what? It never went up. And we're 15 months since then. Here's what happened. And I spoke to her the other day for my stories in the Concord Monitor and in Seacoast Online on this. She had asked the artist to make changes to the portrait. It had been with the artist ever since. Walensky got involved, looked for answers. Now the portrait is back in the hands of the state, and the executive council just the other day unanimously voted 5-0 to allow the portrait to be hung. But now, Peter, the big question is, where in the State House will it be hung?
Is there a prominent place that she's hoping for? Or?
She would like to see it in the Executive Council chambers, as does Walensky. There is, if you're in the chamber room, there is one panel left where there's room for another painting. All the other portraits there are a lot of people, a lot of men. Obviously, they're all men from the 1700s and 1800s. So it could be interesting to see where the state government decides this painting will hang.
I was just going to say happy belated International Women's Day, everybody.
Thank you, Annie. I appreciate that.
You're welcome.
This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on the Exchange. We've got a lot of news to get through this week, and we're doing it with you, we hope. We've got some emails in response to subjects we've already discussed. Want to bring these folks into the conversation. Regarding the transgender bill that advanced this week, Robin wrote in to say, I don't care about the bathroom issue, but isn't it problematic to have a law that is based on a person's internal sense of identity? Is there any other law anywhere that is applicable or not, depending on someone's inner feelings? I think the answer is yes. Other states do have this law, right, Annie?
Yeah, and I think that supporters of this bill would debate that this is just a feeling, like something that could be chalked up to a whim, as opposed to an inner identity, even, you know, so far as a mental, you know, a dysphoria that is a true something more than a feeling, I think, would be the argument.
I'm glad we were able to get that comment in. Thank you very much, Robin. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on the Exchange. We're going to be talking about the VA when we come back from the break. Give us a call, 1-800-892-6477, or email exchange at nhpr.org. I'm Peter Biello. We'll be right back.
Everyone could do with a bit of Irish luck now and again, which is why you should support NHPR today. When you do, you'll get not one, but two chances to win a trip to Dublin, Ireland, courtesy of Milne Travel American Express. That's two chances to see the brilliant Cliffs of Moher, stroll through St. Stephen's Green, or drink in some knowledge at the Old Jameson Distillery. The lucky winner will be picked on St. Paddy's Day, but you can increase your odds now with your gift today at nhpr.org.
This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on the Exchange on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello, here in the studio with NHPR's Annie Ropeek, Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at SNHU, and the author of the website NH Political Capital, and political reporter Paul Steinhauser. And with you, we hope. Give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. We'll start this last third of the show talking about the VA, because there were a few above-the-fold headlines this week about Dr. Mayo Smith, Dr. Michael Mayo Smith, who was the VA New England Healthcare Systems Director, overseeing not just the Manchester VA, but also the White River Junction, Vermont VA, VAs in Boston, Bedford, Massachusetts, Maine. Problems at a variety of these centers sort of put him in the crosshairs. The day after Representative Annie Custer called for his removal, VA Secretary David Shulkin did actually say that he was going to retire, along with two other network directors across the country. Dean, what exactly had Dr. Mayo Smith done to merit this?
Well, he has been a source of frustration among the whistleblowers who set all this in motion for some time. When the problems at the VA were discovered, he was someone that people pointed fingers at, and then he was involved, I believe, at least initially in the commission to study and figure out what the problems were. He was then removed from that. But he's been a subject of strong criticism for some time now as being part of the problem and not part of the solution. And so as the calls for his ouster have grown, he's conveniently decided that he should retire. We talked, I think, last week about sort of the initial study that suggested that Manchester not get a full-service VA, which is something that Senator Shaheen and other members of our delegation have been pushing for, and that actually the focus should be on partnerships with other local providers rather than an additional full center. So Mayo Smith, as I said, every time we talk about the story and the problems at the VA, he's kind of at the center, or one of the people at the center of the criticisms. So now he's sort of finally has run out of time.
Yeah, there were a variety of stories, not just at the Manchester VA. They may have escaped local press notice here. But at the Bedford VA, for example, there was a story of a veteran who apparently had died because the nurse who was supposed to be checking on him by the hour essentially was playing like a handheld video game or something like that. That was in the Boston Globe. And all that seems to go straight to the leadership of what they call the Veterans Integrated Service Network, VISN1, Michael Mayo Smith. Tough situation.
Huge issue here in New Hampshire. Obviously, we have one of the highest per capita of vets in the country. But it's going to be a huge issue in the second congressional district race as Annie Custer runs for re-election for a fourth term in Congress, because Dr. Stuart Levinson, one of the Republicans' challengers, was one of those whistleblowers. And the two other Republicans in the race are both veterans as well. So you're going to hear a lot about this on the campaign trail, especially in the second district this summer and this fall.
Yeah, it'd be interesting to see what they have to say. Stuart Levinson, of course, critical of Annie Custer, mm-hmm. saying she didn't do enough soon enough to A, address the problems at the Manchester VA, and B, call for the ouster of Dr. Mayo Smith, who the whistleblowers say was part of the problem. Worth mentioning before we move on from the VA stuff is that task force looking at the future of healthcare for New Hampshire's veterans is not quite done with its work. They're going to be having another two-day meeting next week, the 14th and 15th, where they finalize the sort of draft report that they put out earlier this month. So that's exactly what I will be following next week. So we'll stay on top of that. But anyway, we've got more stories to talk about this week, including CD1, because former New Hampshire Republican Party Vice Chair Matt Mayberry of Dover has decided not to run for CD1. So I guess he's in the minority, right? Because everybody else seems to be running in CD1.
We got 11 candidates in this race, yeah. Right? So I guess we're not going to have a 12th this week. Mayberry, interesting guy. And I know him pretty well, obviously, through he works for Bill Binney, and I was part of Binney Media for quite some time. Mayberry, openly gay. He's one of the leaders also of the New Hampshire chapter of the Log Cabin Republicans. Well respected by Republicans across the state. from those who love Donald Trump to those who hate Donald Trump. If he had jumped in, he may have been able to garner a lot of support from all sides. There are only two other or three other Republicans right now running, but Mayberry ultimately decided not to just make a bid.
Huh? Why? Do we know?
I think a lot of reasons. I think there were some personal issues. I think he just felt the time was not right for him. This doesn't preclude him from running in the future, and he said he's going to remain pretty active.
Okay, but and so a lot of candidates in the race, possibly one more. Bruce Crochetier of Hampton Falls, founder and chairman of Focus Technology Solutions, successful business in Seabrook. Possibly join. Do we know anything about Bruce?
Yeah, he's as you mentioned, he's a technology a person, IT company founder and chairman. He has said he's close to getting in or likely to get in. Is kind of close to the vest at this point in terms of positions. He doesn't want to. He wants to save that for an announcement. I think the interest here among the RNC is that he's a wealthy individual and capable of. Investing in the race, as they say, basically self-funding.
And I will say this, because I've said it before in your program, and I say it in every article I write about the first district, which is a lot. This is one of the best congressional districts in the country. It is a top swing district. It's one of the most high-profile districts. It's ping-pong back and forth between the Republicans and Democrats, Shea Porter and Frank Ginter, the former Republican congressman, the last four cycles. And guess what? For the first time in 16 years, we don't have an incumbent running for re-election. And it's only one of 12 districts won by Donald Trump in 2016 that the Democrats control. That's why there's so much attention on New Hampshire's first congressional district.
Yeah, and I saw an item just the other day, I believe, that a top Democratic advocacy group has already reserved tens of millions of dollars
that
in advertising.
That, yes.
Okay, then go ahead. Tell. I think listeners would be interested.
Yeah, the House Majority PAC, which is the top outside group that backs Democrats, they've reserved money. And they do. This is something normal, but they reserve money for the last couple of weeks of the election on TV and radio here and 33 other districts. So it's got the attention of the national players.
All right. Something worth mentioning about that, the swingiest of swing districts happening on the seacoast. Annie, this is your wheelhouse here. The Department of Environmental Services is recommending the State Site Evaluation Committee approve this 13-mile seacoast power line project, the Reliability Project, with some conditions. So tell us about this power line and what are those conditions?
Yeah, so this is what they call a reliability project, which is Eversource's response to what the region's grid operator, ISO New England, says is a need for basically more flexibility and backup options and sort of transmission lines along the transmission lines in case something happens. You know, it ensures reliability on the system. And so they have asked the utilities to come up with solutions to that problem. This is one of Eversource's solutions. They just finished a similar project in Merrimack that goes down to Massachusetts, and this is the Seacoast Reliability Project. So this would run from about Portsmouth up across Little Bay into, I believe, no, let me see here.
It Newington?
Yeah, well, it's across Little Bay between Durham and Newington, so kind of imagine a straight line through those two towns, and you get a 13-mile power line here, which would go for about a mile under Little Bay. So the conditions that DES is proposing, and these are recommendations they were supposed to come out with last August. It's delayed the proceedings for all that time, and they're now going to be able to restart those proceedings. But the conditions center on that the buried part that goes under the bay. So DES wants to see Eversource try some other ways to do it than what's called jet plowing, which is what they had planned to do, where they basically blow a trench into the bottom of the bay and lay the line down and let the sediment resettle on top of it. So DES is saying we have some concerns about this. The water quality impacts, you know, stirring up all that silt could be bad for the bay. And we would like you guys to try digging a tunnel, basically, so you kind of go in one place, come out the other. You don't have to stir everything up along the way. So they want them to explore both options and kind of come up with some analysis.
Is this project developing a lot of opposition from environmentalists?
Yes, it's been controversial in the Seacoast ever since it was proposed. I mean, this is, you know, I think the docket is dated 2015 at the Site Evaluation Committee. It's one of those, you know, and it's a lot smaller scale than, say, Northern Pass, but, you know, it's drawn a lot of controversy in its area down on the Seacoast. And environmentalists will certainly be turning out at the Site Evaluation Committee to talk about this when it now comes back up because they have the DES recommendations in hand.
This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on the Exchange on NHPR. Call us now to ask your questions or make comments about the week's news. We'd love to hear from you. 1-800-892-6477. email exchange at nhpr.org. And Paul, you wanted to jump in?
Yeah, because you're talking about the environment in the Seacoast. And I will say a victory for environmentalists in the State House of Representatives this week, a bill that would force the state to clean up the Coakley landfill, that Superfund site that's got a lot of people in the Seacoast nervous. That passed the State House of Representatives. Now it moves on to the State Senate.
Yeah, no, it's a really interesting bill. They basically want the DES to step in and do what the EPA is not doing, honestly. They have potentially responsible parties, so these are the towns and business entities that are kind of liable for the pollution at Coakley Landfill. And the bill sort of spells out how DES is allowed to get those parties to pay up to restart remediation in a more serious way than EPA has been willing to do.
And this is an issue where there is bipartisanship, definitely, on the Seacoast. Republican and Democratic state lawmakers in the Seacoast are all uniform on this one. It was also championed by Mindy Mesmer. She's a state rep from Rye, a Democrat. And guess what? She also happens to be running for Congress in that amazing first district race.
So we've got a few more stories to discuss before the end of the hour. Paul, I'll ask you about Hope for New Hampshire Recovery, because apparently they're getting some money, yes?
Yeah, this has been a story you guys have been talking about, everybody's been talking about over the last couple of weeks, because Hope for New Hampshire Recovery, which is one of the state's largest operators of drug recovery centers, they announced last month that they would be closing four of their five locations across the state, only keeping the Manchester one open. And they cited a lack of funding. A lot of their funding comes from the state of New Hampshire. It had been held up since last summer because of a lot of issues, including some maybe mismanagement at Hope for New Hampshire Recovery. The Executive Council unanimously approving on Wednesday $600,000 for Hope for New Hampshire Recovery. That'll allow them to keep Manchester open, reopen Berlin and Franklin. The Claremont and Concord centers, though, probably will not be reopening. And now the big discussion is, well, what will happen there? What other organizations will help out in those two areas?
Mm-hmm. Another issue to discuss, postponing elections. I mean, last year's town meeting day got some snow. Who knows? We may get some snow next week during town meeting day. You never know in New England what kind of weather we're going to get. But New Hampshire Secretary of State Bill Gardner is saying, do not cancel these elections or postpone these elections, rather, because of bad weather. Towns tried to do that last year, and it was kind of a big mess.
It was chaos. About a third of the towns across the country postponed because we did have that big storm. But the state Senate passing this bill now just yesterday, just last night, 16-8, to allow, basically giving the Secretary of State the power here over the towns to try to keep the chaos away. But a lot of towns are jealous of this because, remember, this is a state that where towns jealously, you know, guard their rights. Town managers and moderators feel that they're being trampled here by the Secretary of State and by Concord.
Yeah, it is an issue of local control. And the distinction that Gardner was trying to make, you know, some of these moderators said they had the right to postpone the vote. And his argument was, no, you can postpone the business, the meeting and the discussion and the debate, but the actual balloting day you cannot tamper with. So, I mean, that's sort of at the root of all of this.
I just love this. I just want to say I think this is the most New Hampshire thing ever, that we're arguing about local control to not postpone town meetings because of snowstorms, essentially.
People who come from other states are amazed that you get to vote on, like, paving a sidewalk. You get to vote on that here in New Hampshire. You don't get that in other states.
Yeah, absolutely.
Check so many New Hampshire boxes. Awesome.
We're excited for town meeting week next week. That's what I have to go work on after this, is all of our town meeting preview stories. Can't wait.
Boy. We've got Woo-hoo! So much to do next week. It's not even funny. All right, but let's talk about Chessie Prout, because her new book came out. Annie, hold up the book for the cameras, because we've got cameras in the studio now. Everybody take a look at Facebook Live. So this book, she published a book about her experiences as a survivor of sexual assault at St. Paul's School in Concord. But Annie, it's supposed to be more than just an account of what happened.
Yeah, I mean, it's really interesting. This is published under the teen label of Simon & Schuster, which I just think is really cool. I mean, that we have a book that's geared toward teen. It's by, you know, co-written with a teen about sexual assault and survivors' rights. And she sort of spells out on the back of the book like a survivor's bill of rights that, you know, I have a right to use my voice when I'm ready and to be happy and sad without being judged and to be heard and to stand with other survivors. So I think that she's trying to spell out some solutions and advocate for people like her and not just tell her story in this book.
Yeah, and worth noting that Chessie Prout will be talking with NHPR's Rick Ganley about the book next week. On the Today Show, Chessie Prout reflected on her role in the ongoing investigation into sexual assault at St. Paul's School.
It shouldn't be on a now 19-year-old's shoulders to take on a 162-year-old institution, a sort of old boys network. And so I'm grateful for the Attorney General of New Hampshire for continuing his investigation into the misconduct of St. Paul's School, because there's a lot to be told there.
Yeah. Owen Labrie, the perpetrator, was convicted of misdemeanor sexual assault and child endangerment. He's been asking for a new trial. That's apparently going to be going all the way to the state Supreme Court. St. Paul School, for its part, has said that it doesn't support or foster an environment where something like this would happen. There are folks who would disagree with that, but that's what the school has said. So this will be interesting. And interesting, too, Annie, that you point out that that was for teens. The book is marketed to teens.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think it's going to be marketed in all kinds of ways. But I just did notice when I was looking at the back of the book that it's, you know, it's under the Simon & Schuster teen label. And so I do think that's interesting. You know, it's kind of packaged in a teen lit kind of way. It'll be interesting to see what section of the bookstore it goes in, you know. And I think there's something to that we're not just speaking to politicians and families here, but to teen survivors themselves.
Later today, I'll be speaking to Erin Moulton for a conversation for The Bookshelf from NHPR, a series of books by local authors. Erin's an author and a librarian, and she was inspired to put together a book called Things We Haven't Said, which is stories of survivors of sexual assault. And one of the things that she was inspired by, as she wrote in the introduction to this book, was that there was not very much literature about sexual assault for teenagers.
Yeah.
So it's interesting that this book now by Chessie Prout and also Things We Haven't Said, seeking to sort of fill that gap in the book market. So that's something that I will be focusing on today for next week. And I wanted to ask you, Annie, and then you, Paul and Dean, what you'll be following next week. I guess any town meeting day stuff.
Well, Peter, it's our fun drive next week.
Oh, don't remind me.
Yeah, no, we have lots of town meetings to cover. I have two site evaluation committee deliberative sessions to go to, one about Northern Pass, which is on Monday, about restarting Eversource's appeal process and where that's going to go. And then the one about Seacoast reliability is on Wednesday. So stay tuned for more. It's also New Hampshire Energy Week next week, so there will be lots of legislative breakfasts and events with politicians in Concord about energy policy and renewable energy.
You must be so excited.
So excited. I live for this.
How about you, Paul? What's coming on next
week? Energy is a big issue here, though. It is a huge issue. We all agree in New Hampshire. Well, the State Senate and the State House are back. More big votes. The March madness at the State House continues. But also, we're the first in the nation primary state, right? So the 2020 race is underway. Guess who's coming next week? Jeff Flake, the U.S. Senator from Arizona, who's considering a primary challenge against Donald Trump. I spoke to him last night. You'll see my article in the Concord Monitor this weekend, and I'll cover him for Fox News next week when he's here.
Fantastic. Thanks, Paul. And what about you, Dean? What will you be looking at next week?
The Jeff Flake visit will be really interesting. March 23rd is crossover day when 22nd, everything from the House goes to the Senate and the Senate to the House. So we are in the final crunch there at the state legislature. Also interesting to see how the gun debate continues to percolate here with that big march coming up, I think also March 23rd or 24th or 5th, something like that. But it's in a couple weeks. So keeping an eye on the gun debate in the state as well.
All right. We didn't receive any notes about people reporting tunnels in New Hampshire.
I did tweet about it, but I didn't get any tweets
nothing,
back either.
Aside from the one that might be going
right,
under Little Bay.
I'm digging a tunnel.
Nice.
I'm on the way.
Full circle.
So I just want to make this comment from James in Berlin, who wrote in regarding the voting discussion that we had earlier. If college students are no longer able to vote in the state they are attending university, what is stopping states from taking the opposite stance and saying you can't vote in a state unless you live there? And with all the issues surrounding mail-in absentee ballots, where are they going to be able to vote? That's the question from James in Berlin. No time to answer your question here, James, but the conversation does continue online at our Facebook page, NHPR Exchange. Check it out there. You can find all the stories that we discussed today at our website, nhpr.org. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. Our engineer is Dan Colgan, senior producer Ellen Grimm. Our producers are Jessica Hunt and Christina Phillips. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. And I'm Peter Biello. Thank you very much for listening, and have a great weekend.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.